Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 22nd of March, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, it's great to have Ben Rubin.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. We've got Debbie Evans with us today as well, and also a special guest. Now, we are going to get started off with hatred, because, of course, hatred is the top of the headlines at the moment, particularly hatred in Scotland. And Humza Yousaf is not terribly excited about what's going on in terms of the response to the hate bill, or the hate act, as it now is in Scotland. There's been a lot of disinformation spread on social media, he says, through some inaccurate media reporting and by political opponents. So what is he talking about? Well, this is this new law which comes into force, and we're going to give a little bit of the detail on it at the moment, but it extends the offence of stirring up hatred to other things like age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, transgender identity, and variations in sex characteristics, otherwise known as intersex. Now, of course, a lot of the furore over this came with Police Scotland putting this webpage up and creating their Hate Monster campaign. And this resulted in huge derision online and so on. If you go looking for this page now, this is what you get, a 404 page not found. Now, in the mainstream press, they are denying that the Hate Monster is dead, but it's certainly been taken down from the website in the meantime. Now, we might be making light of this. Actually, there's an extremely serious aspect to this, and I just want to look at some of the text from the Police Scotland National Guidance on the issue. So let's look at what it says. For recording purposes, in other words, for the police to record this as I see my fonts are a bit messed up, so I do apologise for this. For recording purposes, the perception of the victim or any other purpose is the defining factor in determining whether an incident is a hate incident or is recognised, or in recognising the malice element of a crime. The perception of the victim, Ben, right? Let's go on with it. And this is also going to be a bit wrong. But anyway, the perception of the victim should always be explored. However, they do not have to justify or provide evidence of their belief, and police officers or staff members should not directly challenge this perception. Evidence of malice and ill will is not required for a hate crime or hate incident to be recorded and thereafter investigated as a hate crime or hate incident by police. It goes on. The alleged actions of the perpetrator must amount to a crime under Scottish crime recording standard rules. So fair enough, it has to be a crime. If this is the case, the perception of the victim or any other person will decide whether the crime is recorded as a hate crime. And finally, if the facts do not identify a recordable crime, but the victim perceives it to be a hate crime, the circumstances will be recorded as a hate incident, not non-crime incident. But I don't know what you think about this, Ben, but it seems incredible to me that they are really trying to get away with evidence not being required in order for an event to be recorded as a hate crime and therefore investigated by the police. And the question then is, where does that end? The police could be, and perhaps this is the way that campaigners might go, police could be overwhelmed by this extremely quickly if every comment that anybody makes is reported as some kind of hate crime.
I mean, it's a total perversion of due process. And yeah, I think it could descend into chaos very quickly. Maybe that's the point.
Well, maybe it is. Debbie, I don't know if you've got any thoughts on this.
Well, yes, I certainly have. Good afternoon, everybody. After speaking to the youngsters that I spoke to with regards to Prevent and what's happening in England, you know, you've only got to say something and it gets reported to a Prevent officer, and then you get a knock on the door. And if that knock on the door, the person that's knocking on the door deems your comment to be discriminatory or a matter of national security, it's a police investigation. So it's just Prevent on speed, I think, in Scotland.
It is indeed. Now, let's just bring this up from the Scottish Union for Education, because if you want to know more about this, there's no better place to go. And Stuart Whitten, who's been on this programme, has written for us in the past, is involved with this organisation. What I'm looking at here is Scottish Union for Education newsletter number 60. And they're making two real points here, Debbie. First of all, as you say, Does this mean that children who are often or can be acerbic at times are going to be being reported on a widespread basis? And if they are being reported on a widespread basis, what effect is that going to have on their future lives, on their future careers, if they have a black mark against them from the age of nothing? And we already have a regime in England, for example, where children are in primary schools are having instances of whatever kind of behavior recorded and this on a piece of paper, and this piece of paper follows them through right through to adulthood. So this is a pretty difficult direction to be going in. But then the other point that they also make, of course, is that teachers and lecturers are likely to be on the receiving end of comments from students, in fact, as we know from the David Miller case, where he lost his job at Bristol University for making what were alleged to be anti-Semitic comments. Where does this end, Debbie?
Well, the consequences ripple on throughout lives. I mean, it's going to get worse before it gets, and we all need to be aware of it, and we need to be standing up against it. It's as simple as that. We need to be talking about it.
Yes, indeed. Okay, now let's come to you then and move on to health issues. And, well, blood, first of all.
Yeah, let's talk blood. Now, for an adult man weighing about 200 pounds, they'll have about 12 pints of blood. That's 6 litres. For women weighing 165 pounds, you're looking at around 4.3 litres, which equates to 9 pints. So blood is unique. It is unique to us. It's a very, very precious commodity. And I want to talk about blood transfusion in particular. Now, I'm not going to touch on the unvetted vaccinated blood debate, because you'll see where I'm going with this segment. So that's a whole new segment of its own. But blood's thicker than water. Blood brothers. Well, let's remind ourselves of the hepatitis blood inquiry, which actually this has been going on for 40 years. And the victims of, and some of them are dead actually, but the victims still haven't received any compensation. So we know that there are massive problems with infected blood, but it seems as though we haven't learnt our lessons. But there are other uses of blood. And back in 2017, BBC Three was reporting a story about the super rich were injecting blood from teenagers to gain immortality. Now, this was a clinical trial that was held in San Francisco that was offering blood transfusions for older patients from younger people, and that was plasma. And we're looking at £6,200 for 2.5 liters of plasma. Now, these blood transfusions back then were being promoted at society galas. It was a big thing. So you bought your ticket for the gala for $195, and then you would get a handout once you got there. Now, if you look further into what you actually had to do when you got the handout, is that you would have to pay $285,000 to enroll on this clinical trial and this scheme to be able to be transfused with young plasma. Now, there was plenty of interest. There was one company called Ambrosia, and Ambrosia started the whole thing. But there have been other companies like Cellularity and Google, Calico, plenty of interest in young blood, even to the point of using placentas, placental blood. So this was all about age reversal, right, and immortality. But the FDA soon put their foot down and said that absolutely not, we cannot use young blood. And that's why I'm titling this segment Young Blood. We cannot use young blood for this purpose. However, the narrative has changed. So what has it changed into? Well, it's changed into using young blood for Alzheimer's. So if we look at this study here, young blood at a plasma administration to fight Alzheimer's disease. Now, this is basically young plasma, and it says that it has potential therapeutic properties by ameliorating aspects of disease present in Alzheimer's disease patients, and the clinical trials are underway. Now, Interesting Engineering also brought out a very interesting article in 2023. So we're coming right up to date now, 2023, where researchers have been finding that young blood could have rejuvenating effect when infused into older bodies to rejuvenate heart muscle and generally organs. But then in 2024, March, so this month, this has just been published. And this is exercised blood plasma promotes hippocampal neurogenesis in the Alzheimer's disease of a rat brain. Now, the hippocampus is in the limbic system, and it holds all your memories, your working memory, your rote memory, autobiographical memories. So you can see how that plays into Alzheimer's. But if we go to look at the conclusion of that paper, you can see that it says our proof of concept study demonstrates that plasma from exercise trained donors can protect neuronal cells in culture and promote hippocampal neurogenesis in Alzheimer's disease rat brains. Now, I just want to rewind a little bit to a TED talk that was given 8 years ago. This was given by Professor Tony Weiss-Corre. Now, he's a professor of neurology at Stanford, and he studies degeneration and the degeneration of brains. And I want you to listen very carefully just to the end of his talk. Let's have a listen.
So to summarize, we find the old mouse and its brain in particular are malleable. They're not set in stone. We can actually change them. They can be rejuvenated. Young blood factors can reverse aging. And what I didn't show you, in this model, the young mouse actually suffers from exposure to the old. So there's old blood factors that can accelerate aging. And most importantly, humans may have similar factors because we can take young human blood and have the similar effect. Old human blood, I didn't show you, does not have this effect. It does not make the mice younger. So is this magic transferable to humans? We're running a small clinical study at Stanford where we treat Alzheimer's patients with mild disease with a pint of young plasma from young volunteers, 20-year-olds, and do this once a week for 4 weeks. And then we look at their brains with imaging. We test them cognitively, and we ask their caregivers for daily activities of living. What we hope is that there are some signs of improvement by this treatment. And if that's the case, that could give us hope that what I showed you works in mice might also work in humans. Now, I don't think we will live forever, but maybe we discovered that the fountain of youth is actually within us, and it has just dried out. And if we can turn it back on a little bit, maybe we can find the factors that are mediating these effects. We can produce these factors synthetically, and we can treat diseases of aging, such as Alzheimer's disease or other dementias.
So, as we know, Alzheimer's is a big agenda in the UK, and actually the Alzheimer's guidance has been written by our very own Raj Long from the MHRA, who we know has no qualifications either in geriatrics. She's not a geriatrician, she's not a doctor, she's not a psychologist, she's a nobody, but she's written the agenda, and we know that it was high on David Cameron's agenda. So what was interesting about that was they were not just talking about the effects of young blood on old people, but they were talking about the negative effects of older blood within younger people. So my question to everybody out there, and if we've got any hematologists, of which I haven't met very many, but if we have any hematologists, they could perhaps answer that question in the effect that, do we know who we're getting blood from? Would an 18-year-old want to receive my blood, for example? So that's a question I'm throwing out. But on top of that, we can see that the National Citizen Service and the NHS are very busy. They are encouraging teenagers to sign up to donate their first pint. And we've got this first pint campaign going on, which actually means that at 16, please sign up is what they're saying, and you can give as early as 17. So looking at UK fundraising, you can see that they're looking for a lot of people. They're looking for 135,000 new blood donors, specifically 40,000 new black donors. and they're encouraging teenagers to register. But just to finish this segment off, I just want to finish on an article in The Guardian written by Zoe Williams, columnist, who woke up one morning and found an email in her inbox. And it said, would she please donate a kidney? And that's what she received in her inbox. As crazy as it might sound, would she please donate a kidney? She decided she would decline, but maybe in the future she might give some platelets. But are we looking at body parts, organ donation, blood donation?
Okay, thank you, Debbie. Now I'm going to welcome Jackie Devoy to the program at this point. Thank you very much for joining us, Jackie. Now you have, of course, first of all, we remind everybody that we hosted your symposium a few weeks ago on midazolam, and that was an extremely interesting event. If anybody hasn't seen that, please have a look at the UK Column website and watch it if you possibly can. But Jackie, you have a documentary in production at the moment. It's almost finished and ready for premiere.
Yeah, it is. It's called Playing God. I just want to say thank you very much for your support with it and for getting me on the show to talk about it. So Playing God is exposing a medical democide in the UK over the last 50 years. So it's quite a broad look at death by government policy. That's what democide is. So we've been actually working on it for 2 years. It is finished now, and you're going to show it. You're going to be the UK platform that is going to premiere it on April the 22nd. We've also got Children's Health Defence, Robert Kennedy Jr. They've kindly offered to platform it in the US, so that'll be seen worldwide via their site as well. So, it's been in production for 2 years. The reason it's taken that long is because I've crowdfunded it pretty much single-handedly. So, we're stopping and starting quite a lot. We couldn't do it all in one go. We're a small team. There's just four of us. We've got award-winning directors, Naeem Mahmood and his brother, Ash Mahmood. We've got Phil Graham and myself as producers. And, it's looking pretty good. So I think you're going to actually premiere it on the 22nd on UK Column at the same time as Children's Health Defence, I do believe. Is that right?
Yes, that is our intention. So we'll have a page on the front page of the website for that, and we'll give the full details in due course. But just to put your website on screen, just tell us the web address for this.
Yeah, so it's playinggod.uk, very simple. So just one word, playinggod.uk, and you can see updates there. And any information that you might want to find out, you can actually donate there as well, because we're still, even though the film is finished, we're now in the post-production phase, which obviously includes marketing, promotion, distribution. There's still a few more costs before we can actually get it to your screens. So if you can donate, that would be brilliant. There's also a crowdfunder. Look up Playing God Final Phase, and it should pop up on crowdfunder. We've also got a brand new trailer. That's just the teaser there, but we've got a brand new trailer. I don't know. Are you going to show that?
Yes, we're going to show this. Let's have a look at the trailer.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks.
In the last 30 years, you can see good evidence that the National Health Service has become a killing machine.
Elizabeth was killed off after I was criminally assaulted and made to have my baby 2 months early for absolutely no reason at all.
As you can imagine, the trauma of watching your perfectly healthy partner of 21 years just died.
In his medication chart appears he had midazolam and morphine 2 days after he died.
Now I want to know what happened with my steward.
When you go to a hospital, like a National Health Hospital, you go there to be cured. You don't go there to die.
The moment they go into hospital, they're being put onto these hospital protocols, which dictate which drugs, which treatment they're going to receive. And it's a one-size-fits-all blanket policy.
Once procedures are put into a protocol, it becomes a straitjacket. They're literally killing people at the moment.
She was in no pain. There was no shortness of breath. Yet she was on 6 or 7 different forms of medication.
We hadn't known about these side effects. There was nothing in the paperwork that she was given.
The night nurse just pumped him with midazolam and morphine.
Helena Bai was the first fatal case of the drug Epilim.
These big pharmaceutical companies are money-making businesses. They're not healthcare companies. That's what we're dealing with, a money-making, potentially fraudulent, certainly historically criminal enterprise.
And then children are also a market for unlicensed medications.
It's the luck of the draw, whether they benefit or it's causation of death.
The CQC said they would do an investigation, but NHS England stopped it.
Those two doctors were playing God. They were killing people.
She suffered much. She died needlessly. She could have been saved, but she was murdered by the state.
And the thing, just to finish off, Jackie, the thing here is that, you know, people have been talking about Liverpool Care Pathway and so on. But that and the fact that that had been replaced. But the point is, it has been replaced, and there are other care pathways that people are being put on that maybe don't have the same reputation that that one did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Liverpool Care Pathway was abolished in 2014. It shouldn't have been replaced with anything, really. But back in 2020, they brought it back in under the guise of NG163, NG191. The film isn't solely about involuntary euthanasia and care pathways. It's covering democide in a much broader sense. So we're covering drug trials that people have been involuntarily put on, and also jabs, you know, anything that the government's brought in that has killed people, basically, democide.
Yeah. Okay, Jackie, thank you very much. Now, we'll just put the crowdfunder on screen here so that anybody that wants to contribute can do so. And we would encourage that if you possibly can. So, Jackie, thank you very much for joining us today. And we will keep everybody posted for the premiere in the next on the 22nd. It was the 22nd?
Yeah, 22nd of April. Yeah.
Yeah. Monday. Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. Right. We're back. Over to you.
I mean, that film just looked remarkable. And we're going to continue talking about the many and ongoing misdeeds of the British state. There's a lot of excitement going on at the moment about an upcoming election for the lower house of parliament, the House of Commons. But today we're going to have a look at some of the creatures who occupy the unelected upper house, the House of Lords. We're going to start with Baron Mandelson of Foy and Hartlepool, also known as Peter Mandelson, the Prince of Darkness. And towards the end of last year, he was asked to give some advice to David Cameron on his return to a senior ministerial position from the Lords.
You mentioned David Cameron's return and the fact that you welcome it. What advice do you have for him on how to be a successful senior minister from the Lords in a surprise return to government?
Love them. Love them to bits. Love the Lords. Go there, be open, be warm, be friendly, be congenial, and in return they'll love you back.
Not in his case.
Love the Lords. So congenial, so smooth. Honestly, British politicians. Well, Mandelson loved the Lords. Who else does Mandelson love? He loves this fella, Jeffrey Epstein. Epstein used to call him Petey, you know. He had a little pet name for Mandelson. Here they are sharing a birthday cake. Epstein, obviously, the notorious paedophile, human trafficker, Mossad agent. And he was such good friends with Mandelson that he had every single contact detail you could possibly want. His direct number, multiple addresses. They were clearly incredibly close. And Mandelson is still advising top politicians in the UK Labour Party. I don't understand how this is possible with that track record, but he is actually one of the main influences over Keir Starmer. He's viewed as a core part of the advisory network surrounding a man who could potentially be the next Prime Minister of the country. Remarkable. So who was Mandelson giving advice to in that little video clip? He was speaking to Baron Cameron of Chipping Norton, David Cameron, former Prime Minister, bombed Libya for Obama, helped overthrow Gaddafi, which led directly to the reopening of open-air slave markets in Libya, and has enabled the mass migration into southern Europe over the past few years, which Gaddafi had done a very effective job of ending during his leadership of the country. He was also caught up in the Green Seal, scandal. So he was lobbying government contacts for access to COVID emergency funds. He was paid around $10 million in 2.5 years for a part-time advisory role before Greensill collapsed in 2021. Just who you want representing you on the international stage. He also helped American genomics firm Illumina secure £123 million of government contracts via an introduction to Matt Hancock. He's an ongoing advisor to Illumina. I believe that actually makes him a member of the Illuminati, by the way.
Might do.
Yeah, I think it does. Right. Yes. After committing us to two ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and Israel, he spent the start of this year celebrating with a trip to the Satanic Temple at Gull's house in Davos, just to let us know exactly whose side he's on. He's also the chairman of NCS, by the way. Debbie was talking about NCS trying to get young people to donate a pint of blood. David Cameron is the chairman of that organisation. Nothing sinister about that at all. Now, Cameron is very, very close with this fella, Lord Bethel of Romford, Jim Bethel, who has ministerial responsibility for innovation and was absolutely front and centre in the COVID scenario. He was actually personally responsible for overseeing all COVID procurement. And we're going to have a little clip from him now talking about his relationship with China as part of that process.
I completely agree with those speakers who have noted the failure by the government to publish a clear China strategy. Noble Baroness Baroness D'Souza was quite right when she said that that is a big mistake. My area is the area of innovation, and I want to just talk about what the implications are of that mistake for the area of innovation. Now, I saw for myself as a health minister during the pandemic the absolutely critical importance of trade and scientific dialogue with China. When the supply chains collapsed, I was on the phone trying to rustle up PPE from suppliers, literally standing on the tarmac of Hong Kong Airport. And I was had a role in the £3.5 billion worth of LFDs that had been bought off China that were incredibly important to our battle against COVID. And I gave ministerial oversight to the development of new therapeutics and diagnostics, often with Chinese academic partners and suppliers involved. So I am in no doubt about the value of Chinese scientists to some of the great challenges of our time.
So he was on the tarmac of an airport in China, personally cutting deals with PPE manufacturers and spending billions of pounds of taxpayer money. He was actually caught up in a scandal directly as part of this. There was an £85 million contract that he was personally involved in that was put in question. And he had personal ministerial oversight of the development of new therapeutics working with the Chinese state. Right? I mean, this guy is absolutely in the thick of everything that we've seen over the past few years. He was also the author of this report, Genome UK, The Future of Healthcare, which basically sets out a vision of a biotechnological industry focused on genetic engineering, manipulation of the human genome, and which would actually make us dependent on technology acquired from Illumina, which is where David Cameron is helping out also has very, very deep links into the Israeli technology ecosystem that Vanessa spoke about on the news earlier this week. Now, finally, I want to finish up by talking about this gentleman, Baron Vasey of Didcot. And we're going to show a short video here of him speaking on a panel about elections, misinformation and democracy at the AI Fringe in November last year.
Yeah, we weren't allowed to do a Q&A, but we should have done, shouldn't we? Because everyone wants to get stuck in now.
Talk about censorship.
Okay, what do you want to say about censorship?
Talk about the censorship of the Hunter Biden laptop by Twitter Trust and Safety Team in the run-up to the 2020 presidential election. Talk about that.
I don't know anything about that.
I have no clue.
Who was that, Ben?
So that was Baron Vasey and a lady called Sei Akiwowo. She's a former Labour councillor in Newham and a feminist campaigner type person. And she was also a member of the Twitter Trust and Safety Team in the UK. So both of them just denied knowledge of the existence of the Hunter Biden laptop. By the way, that was me who had that made that little interjection. If that wasn't clear, I didn't say it. But yeah, I thought I'd take the opportunity to pose a question to the noble lord while he was sat there in front of me going on about elections and disinformation and being incredibly disingenuous. Now, Baron Vasey, if you're listening, just to be clear, this is what I was talking about. Right. So this is Hunter Biden's laptop. It was widely available on the internet in October 2020, 3 years before our little altercation there in King's Cross back in November last year. And it was easily validated by anyone with access to the internet and the stomach to go through the contents. It's absolutely remarkable. And I suggest going to look at the Marco Polo report on the laptop and its contents, which demonstrate a network of corruption into Ukraine and China. Straight into the top of US politics. Obviously, Hunter Biden is Joe Biden's son, and further afield. But obviously, Vasey, you know, we can tell from the way he responded there, and from more recent comments, he's a big fan of censorship. He spoke about the Online Safety Act being an important act. This was from a recent statement in the House a couple of weeks ago. It says the Online Safety Act regulates the content of the platforms and gave Ofcom very important powers to regulate them, because you don't want that nasty misinformation floating around. He also went on to say that our public broadcasters are important because many of the senior executives that you meet at global media corporations trained at places like the BBC. He actually sees that as a way of projecting soft power, actually probably more like hard power across the world, actually. I mean, this is working with big, referring to big streaming platforms like Netflix and Disney and Amazon and what have you. And Lord Vasey, just to finish up, is another one of these remarkable individuals who seems to be an incredibly important high-level political figure, but also has his own radio show on Times Radio that he's very excited about, bringing people through from AKQA, which is owned by WPP, the big communications network, Kurt Geiger, the apparel brand, and apparently sees absolutely no issue with this. And he even had the gall in his speech to big up Times Radio in the House of Lords, which I thought demonstrated a total lack of class on his part.
Okay, let's move on. If you like what the UK Column does, you would like to support us, please head over to support.ukcolumn.org. All the options for helping us out are there. We do need your support, because it's only through that that we can continue doing what we're doing. You could pick something up at the UK Column shop, and we'll have a little bit more to say about that in a second. Do share anything you find on the various platforms, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. Now, I'm going to say a massive thank you, because something arrived on our doorstep today.
Yeah.
Let's bring it on screen. Ben was quickly out with his phone to record this. This is a gift from Bob Moran. And I'm going to say thank you very much, Bob. This is spectacular. Help me out here. Because I don't know what else to say. I mean, we unwrapped this, and two amazing pictures.
Yeah, I mean, what an incredible thing to arrive in the office on a Friday morning, right? I mean, it's such a treat. He's one of the most insightful and effective satirists and commentators on the entire situation that we've been through. I mean, his work has been absolutely incredible, just pointing out the hypocrisy and the horror, really, of the whole situation, but making it, you know, laughable and entertaining at the same time is quite a skill.
Yes. So, Bob, thank you. Quite amazing. And those will be going up on the wall very, very soon. Now, Debbie, let's go back to the UK Column shop, because we have something available there that's, I suppose, an exclusive.
It certainly is. I have to say, just wow, 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 Bob Moran. Every picture tells a story, doesn't it? I mean, that's just amazing. And this too, I mean, we have got a very, very limited number of this book, which, thank you so much to the collaboration between everybody at UK Column, Cheryl Granger, and the Daily Clout who have managed to arrange this. We have a very limited edition now of this Pfizer documents analysis reports. If you were to buy this from America, you would probably wait a while for it to be delivered and you would be paying over £60. But we've got a limited number. Grab them while you can. £25 plus postage and packing. Incredibly valuable. And I've got a copy.
Thank you, Debbie. And speaking of Cheryl, she will be joining us in Extra.
She certainly will. We will be doing an exclusive post-mortem on the MHRA board meeting, which we both went to, along with quite a number of other people, this week. And it was riveting. So to all of our members and subscribers, please join us for that. It's going to be an exclusive.
Okay. And finally, your blog is up.
Yeah, the war on our minds. I've done a big piece on that. As you can see, NHS electric ambulances and also antimicrobial resistance. And also what's geofencing? You know, when you walk into a shop and suddenly something pops up on your screen and you think, how did my phone know that I was looking at that? It'll explain in my blog this week.
Okay. Thank you, Debbie. And yesterday's interview, of course, on fluoride is up on the UK Column website now, if you would like to go and have a look at that. And then I just want to mention on the 18th of April, there will be a debate on the floor of the House of Commons now on excess mortality related to COVID-19. So Andrew Bridgen, very pleased about that. I'm very pleased about that. So I encourage everybody to watch it live. On the 18th of April. Now, let's just quickly move on and to psychological effects, Debbie, of what?
Yeah, exactly. Well, when I hear words that three times in 24 hours, that's my rule. When I hear the same words, it's a red alert. And I kept hearing this term, psychological safety. Now, we've been hearing loads from doctors, from people in different areas of science who have tried to speak up, but they haven't been allowed to. They've been censored. Or people that are too scared, nurses that are too scared to speak up, people that are too scared because they may lose their job. Well, we have a new agenda and it's being pushed big time and it's called psychological safety. So this is just to give you an example from the Ministry of Defence, how psychological safety is playing a part in most major MOD projects. Now, I just want to bring your attention to Dr. Amy Edmondson. She says there, when people believe they can speak up at work, the learning, innovation and performance of their organisations is greater. Teams and organisations in which people believe that their voices are welcome outperform their counterparts. Dr. Amy Edmondson, Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at Harvard Business School. She's also, she's the pioneer, if you like, of psychological safety. And she was, I don't know how people get awarded these things, but she was awarded something for being the most influential thinker since 2011. I don't know how you measure how you're an influential thinker, but apparently you do. But I've just picked out a very, very short little video for you just to get a flavour of Dr. Amy Edmondson, the pioneer of psychological safety. We'll talk a little bit more about it afterwards.
I heard Lionel Richie tell a fantastic story. He as a young performer, was crippled by stage fright, crippling stage fright. And yet, look at him today, you know, this remarkable performer. And he says the difference between the hero and the coward is not the presence or absence of fear. He says the difference is they both feel fear. The difference is one steps forward and the other steps back.
It's exactly right. It's exactly right. You know, I think I often say that psychological safety and courage are two halves of the same coin, right? It's psychological safety is that belief that when I take a risk around here, it won't prove fatal. But I still have to take the risk. And that's where the courage comes in.
So we have to be psychologically safe in order to challenge the narrative, to question, or even to form a different opinion. But that's obviously not what's happening. So let me take you to a McKinsey article. What is psychological safety? They describe psychological safety as the absence of interpersonal fear. Feeling psychologically safe allows people to perform their best at home, school, and work. And this is all based on something called the Maslow's hierarchical needs. So you can see there are five hierarchical needs. There's physiological needs, which is air, food, drink, shelter, clothing, warmth, sex, and sleep. And then you've got safety needs. So people need order in their life, predictability and control. And of course, what you can see is complete chaos. They need love and belongingness needs. So that's human emotions, interpersonal relationships. Esteem needs are the fourth level. And self-actualization. So that's referring to a person's potential. And there's a little pyramid diagram to show you this hierarchical needs system. And I just want to highlight the safety and security, because we're hearing the words safety and security, peace and security all the time. And it says health, employment, prosperity, family and social ability. Now, in my opinion, we have become socially disabled on purpose. So the whole intention is to disable people. But, you know, psychological safety is a big agenda. So it's the words that I want you to listen out for. Even the World Economic Forum have their fingers in the pot of psychological safety. They say we have a shared belief that team members can feel safe to take chances without being marginalized and punished. Well, that doesn't seem to be happening, does it? Many doctors and many experts are being punished for doing exactly that, speaking out. If we just go back to that WEF slide very quickly, it also says that it's to enable employees to ask questions, to make mistakes, to address difficult topics whilst feeling valued and connected. It's time to build trust. Here we go with the rebuilding trust and respect. But it's not just the WEF, it's the Home Office. So I'll just refer you to this, psychological safety for researchers, and they're using the stress bucket. And perhaps I'll maybe do a no smoke with Brian about allostatic stress and allostatic load and how important stress is and how dangerous and how harmful stress is on the body. But psychological safety literally is everywhere, including, of course, our very own NHS. So NHS providers, psychological safety and why it matters. And the reason that I brought up psychological safety this week is because I heard the buzzwords at the MHRA board meeting. And my question to everyone talking psychological safety is when does psychological safety have a stop sign where people are being discriminated against for trying to speak out, trying to challenge the narrative? So watch out for the word psychological safety.
Yes, good question. Thank you, Debbie, for that. Now let's come on to the issue of war. And well, good news, David Cameron's out of the country in Australia, and so's Grant Shapps. But the bad news, or the less good news, is that they're there to deepening the relationship between the UK and the Australia, otherwise known as AUKUS. So here's what they were pushing out on Twitter this morning, the Ministry of Defence AUKUS update. By working together, the AUKUS partnership is delivering. What's it delivering? Well, it's delivering a new fleet of submarines. These are nuclear-powered submarines. They won't be carrying nuclear weapons, at least not on day one, but they are nuclear-powered submarines. And so part of this was the announcement that BAE Systems design is going to be used for these new submarines. They're going to be built in Australia. But don't worry, 7,000 jobs will be protected in the UK. What else are they saying here? With advanced capabilities from artificial intelligence, autonomy and quantum technologies, to undersea warfare and hypersonic capabilities, deepening defence and security cooperation in the Indo-Pacific. Because you've got to remember, the focus on Russia is only in the short term. The long-term focus is on China. And we are going to go to war with China once we've dealt with Russia. And if you understand the irony in that statement, please don't take it as me being supportive of the idea. But anyway, the Russia narrative continues in the EU. And yesterday, the lovely Ursula von der Leyen and Charles Michel were speaking together about Ukraine, about Russian grain, about defence, about enlargement of the EU, and about Gaza. But defense was really the main focus of the thing. So here's Charles Michel. He was giving the statement that they are more determined to bring more support to Ukraine than ever. The question is, how are they going to do that? Have decided that they need to start spending more and more money, of course. But they've also proposed that a legal task force revisit a crucial provision. And this is known as Article 41 brackets 2, which stops the EU common budget from funding operations having military or defence implications. So they're going to go along and they're going to remove that provision anymore. And this is unprecedented. And it basically gives the European Union, not the member states, but at EU level for the first time, the ability to buy and commission the purchase of weapons and manufacturing of weapons. And this is a key part of European Defence Union. But don't worry, in the meantime, here in the UK, Ukrainian pilots have been learning to fly F-16 fighter jets by flying these things with propellers, because that's going to teach you how to learn to fly an F-16, right? This is how the Royal Air Force was presenting it. But the UK government has announced that 10 pilots have received basic flying ground school and language training in the UK and will one day form the first line of defence in protecting Ukraine's skies from Putin's forces. They will now move from flying these things to advanced jet training. It's going to be the French that are going to provide that level of training. And eventually, at some point in the future, they might get to fly some F-16s. But I'm just going to end this segment on defence with another bit of humour. This is a little bit of video that the Ministry of Defence was pushing out this morning. Just have a look at this. So for anybody that's just listening and not watching the video, that was the Ministry of Defence telling us that Russian exports of arms have fallen by 54%. And of course they've fallen because actually there's only one importer of Russian arms at the moment, and that's Ukraine, isn't it? And sorry to be making a joke of that, but I mean, this whole video was a joke. Russia is not, the implication is that because they're so tied up with the war and they're giving, they're expending so many weapons in Ukraine that they don't have anything to export anymore. Well, surely the key point here, Ben, is they're tied up with a war.
Winning a war.
Yes, indeed. But anyway, tell us about the data for the city of tomorrow.
Data for the city of tomorrow. I spoke about this report a couple of weeks ago, and this is just to kind of tee up and show some continuity between what I was talking about before and what's been happening this week, because the stars have been aligning in London for the just transition to net zero technologies. This is probably the biggest industrial transition that's ever happened in the whole of human history, if these people get their way. We talked about this report from the World Economic Forum. It sets out a roadmap for implementing smart cities anywhere in the world. It was created in a partnership with these two organizations, the Business of Cities, which is a private sector business organization, and Connected Places Catapult, which is a UK government entity. And this week saw the Connected Places Summit arrive in central London.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me give a very warm welcome to the 600 or so people who are here in the room at 22 Bishopsgate.
As the UK's innovation accelerator for cities, transport and place leadership, our mission is clear. We connect people, places and businesses for a future of sustainable growth and prosperity.
Places that aren't connected don't get housing, don't get jobs, and don't contribute to our economy in the 21st century.
What's so good about the Catapult is it's innovation-led. So I'm delighted to be here and delighted to be able to give small and medium enterprises a little bit of a lift.
It's only by joining the dots that the potential of our cities and regions will be unlocked. And the Connected Places Catapult is the glue through which that happens.
I'm delighted that we in DNV are sponsoring the summit. It is about connecting people. It is about meeting industry leaders. It is about meeting technical experts.
What I enjoy most about the summit is being able to connect with people who have the same objectives and the same ambitions for their communities as I have for mine.
I have to say it's been amazing being at the Connected Places Summit, and I'm really excited that we're announcing our partnership with the Connected Places Catapult to be looking at the Crown Estate portfolio and how we can bring innovation to it in new ways.
The Connected Places Summit has been a wonderful moment to network and to share ideas. Yeah, I think it really marks a moment of setting out what we can do in the next 5 years, what can be achieved in the next 10 years, and how we can get on with it.
So that is a public-private marketplace. That is how a fascist system is built. It's how it's enabled. We've got a bunch of extremely high-profile establishment figures promoting this message like it's some kind of organic transition that is just popping up out of nowhere. This is all centrally planned. One of the people that we saw there was Chris Skidmore, former UK energy minister. He said outside of that film that there is no going back, no future economy without a green economy. The work of Connected Places Catapult is so integral. Businesses and industries are raring to go. They want that leadership position of net zero and to start to introduce best practices and take pilots and put them into place nationally and globally. A lot of local politicians there. Here you can see Marvin Rees, OBE's, the mayor of Bristol. One of the challenges with a place, and they love using this word place. Everything's place-based. It's all about place. The thing about that is you should never underestimate the power of very small politics to get in the way of very big delivery. You will have heard of NIMBYs. That's not in my backyard, for people who don't know what that is. But there is a banana. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone. That's Marvin's view on things. And he wants to cut through all of that and get into big delivery like all of these people do. Who else do we have there? Sir John Armitt, CBE, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission. The next government will not have any choice but to pull all of the levers at their disposal if we want to increase UK productivity. And that means increasing public investment in infrastructure. This is absolutely on the top of the agenda for the next government. They've already been told by these people. Who else do we have there? Andrew Ruffin, who I spoke about before, is the chief executive of Plexal, which is the US State Department, MI6, Rothschild family-backed innovation facility based in the Olympic Park in East London. He was there on a panel with Emma Frost, chair of the UK Innovation Districts Group. And actually, it turns out we already have a bunch of these innovation districts that are going to be the hubs for disseminating this technology all around the UK. There's 11 of them, from Glasgow in the north to London in the south and a bunch of other places in between. They talk about themselves as a peer network of UK innovation districts and knowledge quarters. Better together, we enable the delivery of and maximize the benefits from innovation districts and knowledge quarters. They're all about pushing innovation out into the country. And if you remember Jim Bethel earlier talking about his remit as being innovation, a lot of that stuff is coming from him and other people elsewhere in the House of Lords. And we can see how all this stuff is connected. Essentially, this is one organization pushing this forward. There might be some different logos, but actually they're all interconnected via non-exec positions and even just dual roles that people play. So Emma Frost, who's the chair of the UK Innovation Districts Group, is also a strategic advisor to the Business of Cities, which is the organization that partnered with the World Economic Forum on that report. So who's going to pay for all of this? Because it sounds quite expensive. Well, it's going to be a public-private partnership. 3CI, which is another organization that we've already spoken about, which is absolutely in the thick of this new marketplace, issued this report on the same day that the Connected Places Catapult started. As I said, it's been a busy week this week. A whole bunch of things have happened. This report was issued from challenge to opportunity. We've got to unlock a UK-wide net zero investment dividend. Obviously, this is going to pay back to us, the taxpayer. There's no way that it could possibly go wrong, or all of the benefits go to the people investing from overseas and also from home here in the UK. This was launched by this crowd in the House of Commons, obviously, because these people have got access to the halls of power. And there were three recommendations. They said that we need active demonstrators, which is what the innovation hubs will be doing. So they've got to move from theory to practice. We need demonstrators. These are going to address the task force's challenges, starting with pilot projects that take a place-based approach, ensuring community buy-in and tailoring financial models for a just transition. That's another word they love, just transition. This needs to be a national conversation. We've got to get the public involved with this. They're obviously talking about sortition and other democratic innovations to make that possible. And we need an enabling environment, which actually sounds like the language the MHRA uses, where the regulator doesn't get in the way of them doing whatever the hell they want. Essentially, that's what we're looking at here. And then just to finish up, oh, sorry, there's Ed Miliband looking awkward, as he always does. This was also coupled, just by pure coincidence, I'm sure, with the annual CEO summit held at St. James's Palace for the Sustainable Markets Initiative, where the top 100 CEOs from the biggest companies get together to talk about climate. And the chief executive of the Sustainable Markets Initiative, Jennifer Jordan Saifi, said that these people are delivering a private sector leadership and innovation to help drive this important transition that is underway. They're in control of trillions of assets under management. The private sector is playing an outsized role to shift the global economy onto a more sustainable trajectory. So everything is lining up just perfectly for these people to put their plan into action.
Now, we've already talked about censorship and online safety earlier in the program, but I just want to let everybody know that, rest assured, the regulators are at work, and they have been for the last couple of years, but it's starting to build now. So the various regulators in multiple countries absolutely increasingly desperately working to deal with online safety regulation legislation, which is popping up everywhere. In the UK, of course, there's the UK, there's the Online Safety Act, as everybody knows. In the European Union, there's the Digital Services Act. And there are new online safety acts in Ireland and Australia and Singapore and Sri Lanka, a bunch of other countries. And of course, they want to build this global information space, which is basically conducive to Western narratives and the rules-based international order. So let's just bring a little bit of text on here. Membership of the Global Online Safety Regulators Network is open to regulators with legislated online safety functions who meet criteria on independence from political commercial interference and are committed to upholding human rights, democracy, and the rule of law. So, I mean, everybody should be absolutely comfortable with that, Ben. It goes on. Well, first of all, they've got three stages in this. First of all, preparation. That's pretty much at the stage we're at the moment. Then they're going to consolidate this all into one Uber regulator, and then they're going to grow from there. So we've got much more to say on this, but it is just this international network, which of course isn't global at all. It's only Western in its outlook. Continues to build. Now we're going to end then on a little bit of health news. First of all, I just wanted to give everybody a bit of a laugh because the UK government has managed to track down six horse-worming medicines packages which have been seized. This is a package containing horse medicines, was identified by a courier company based at a depot in East Midlands Airport, they said. And the package arrived from the USA containing medicine destined for a residential address in Reading. The medicine was detained and subsequently seized by an inspector from the VMD, that's the Veterinary Medicines Directorate. Of course, what are we talking about here? Ivermectin. They don't want it coming into the country under any circumstances and so on. And just finally on this, the Office of Gordon and Sarah Brown, have issued a joint letter to the leaders of World Health Organization member states calling for an urgent agreement on pandemic accord. So they're getting concerned that this deal is not getting done, right? It's just not getting done. There's too much pushback. And so he has written to them in an effort to get them, give them the confidence to move ahead. And frankly, this is the most unbelievable bit of bad grammar and spelling mistakes and no spaces between words. They're clearly desperate to get this out as quickly as possible, not really paying too much attention into how it was put up. But there you go. And Debbie, we're going to end then with a little bit of video about Jenny Harries.
Yeah, well, I promised to show you this last week. We featured Professor John Bell at the Select Committee, and we were talking that that Select Committee was actually attended by Jenny Harris. Now, let me just paint a very quick picture for you. So Chris Green, who's the MP for Bolton West, at the previous Health Select Committee, asked Dame Jenny Harris about excess deaths, but she couldn't answer the question. So he tries to ask her again. Let's look at Chris Green asking the question again.
Last week on the Science and Technology Select Committee, you asked a question about the data around excess deaths or excess deaths. And you're quite cautious about supporting the release of that data, but you said you look into it. Have you looked into it? Have you?
I'm reaching for my piece of paper.
Let's listen to the answer.
But I think an important point as well is there are very large data sets on things like Open Safely as well, where vaccine mortality has been looked at, and it's actually shown protective effects for when it's actually restricted to non-COVID mortality. So if you like, if you're looking at people who have not had COVID but have had a vaccine, actually there is no increased risk. So this is stepping right away from some of those risks. And if you just look generally, if you look at countries which have had higher vaccine uptake, they have lower excess all-cause mortality. That's quite generalist. But I think the key point here is we have looked. We don't routinely share. We will look. We've got there is a commercial sensitivity element around this, and we will answer that question very soon in full.
Commercial sensitivity, eh?
Yes, and also the claim that people that countries that had higher vaccine uptake had lower excess mortality. Lower than what? I've just been looking at the Office for National Statistics mortality statistics over the last few days and looking at how the change in how we measure what is considered excess mortality has managed to make the number of deaths fall consistently below the which is no longer a five-year average. Of course, they're a new measurement level. So the in my opinion, my personal opinion, those figures are now fiddled and we can no longer get any kind of serious assessment on whether we have excess mortality or not. So for her to sit there and say, well, countries that had more vaccination have had lower excess mortality, I would like to know exactly what she means by that and exactly how she is making that statement or what evidence she's using to base that statement from. But anyway, we will leave it there for today. Thank you very much to Debbie and to Jackie Devoy for joining us today. Thank you, Ben. We'll be back for some extra in a couple of minutes. Cheryl Granger will be joining us. But otherwise, have a great weekend and we'll see you Monday.